100 years ago, the voters of 1912, which did not include women, amended the state constitution to, among other things, give voters the option every 20 years to call for another constitutional convention. This year, that is called Issue 1 on the November 6th statewide ballot. In a nutshell, State Issue 1 asks voters if they want a constitutional convention held to revise, alter, or amend the state constitution. And every 20 years, four times in a row now, the issue has failed. So what purpose would a constitutional convention serve, and when was the last time Ohio ever held one, if ever? Author and historian Ed Lentz is with us today to answer those questions, burning questions, Ed, if the polls are any indication, and of course I'm being facetious.
Well.
But let's talk about the first Constitution. Welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure. Well, when Ohio was settled, the people who put together the state of Ohio largely came from the Jeffersonian tradition. And as you may recall, Thomas Jefferson was firmly of the view that about once every 20 years or so, we ought to just sort of scrap everything and start over again. And that he had that sort of as a founding principle. And that was sort of built into the thinking of the people who wrote the first Constitution back in 1802. The problem with that Constitution, however, was that it was hard to amend. We didn't have that many people living in the state, and trying to come up with enough people to put together a coalition to go for an amended Constitution was just plain tough. They tried once in 1819, but that effort really had a real small vote. It was like 30,000 against having the Constitutional Convention and only 6,000 for. And over the course, however, of the next 20 years or so, opinions changed. And part of the reason for that was that they called it at the time private bills. A lot of the legislating that was being done was not really being done out in front of the public. They were being sort of private bills being put forth and passed rapidly by the legislature. More importantly, the state went deeply into debt to build the Ohio Canal system, to do a bunch of other improvements, and a number of people became convinced that the legislature and the governor were out of control and that this was getting out of hand and we needed something new. So in 1851, we write a new constitution for the state of Ohio, which is, in fact, the one we still have to this day. Is the base constitution is the one that came in 1851. And we have revised it, fiddled with it, played with it on a number of occasions. But about every 20 years, we basically looked at trying to redo it. An effort made in the 1870s failed again. In fact, the only other time we've had a constitutional convention was the voters were asked in 1910 whether or not we should have a constitutional convention. The 1851 Constitution had mandated that every 20 years we be asked that kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the people at that point, high tide of the progressive period, let's go out and make government work for the people, according to Theodore Roosevelt. The people of Ohio said yes, and we had a constitutional convention. I always thought it was sort of intriguing that acronyms were around even back then. The newspapers referred to it as the Con-Con for most of a two-year period. And in 1912, rather than having a whole new constitution, what the convention did was come forth with no less than 41 proposed amendments, which the voters had to deal with and take a vote on. And they covered the widest variety of things, some of which are important even to this day. They put in place initiative, recall, referendum. That comes in the 1912. The other thing was home rule. Prior to 1912, if you wanted a new traffic light in beautiful downtown Obetz, you had to have an act of the Ohio legislature to get that traffic light. And that changes with home rule. And most major cities in Ohio and a number of minor cities in Ohio become home rule cities. Of course, as you mentioned, the big thing that doesn't pass in 1912 is women's suffrage. Women's suffrage movement had been underway.
Well, universal suffrage, because I think the African Americans were on the ballot as well.
They were on there as well, and basically that failed at that point in time. Now, but part of the argument that's going to be made against further constitutional conventions, and of course, as you mentioned, every 20 years we're asked since 1932 whether or not we should have one, and the people have said no. Now, we've had some other things coming along the way in the wake of the 1912 convention. I think what a lot of people were afraid of in the years since the 1912 convention is that what we saw in 1912 was a large number of interest groups, widest variety of people wanting their pet issue passed, including prohibition, suffrage and so on, sort of gang up on the voters and try to force their issues through, and it becomes very controversial, and all sorts of things swirl around.
And these were like the 41 proposed amendments? The
41 okay. proposed, all sorts of odds and ends are proposed as amendments. I can just give you a little bit of a shopping list on some of these things. Limiting the veto power of the governor, investigations by each house of the General Assembly, the initiative and referendum, damages for wrongful death, suits against the state, abolition of capital punishment, reform the civil jury system. And that's just a few. I mean, the list goes on. Trying to ask the voters at one election to sit there and look intelligently at 41 amendments to the Constitution.
Well, how did they do? Did any of them pass?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of them did. As I mentioned, the home rule thing passed,
right.
And initiative, recall, referendum, several of them did pass. But I think what that did was sort of send a shockwave through the whole political system all the way down to the grassroots, where we basically begin to ask ourselves, do we really need these things? Now, does that mean the Constitution never needs to be revised? Well, of course it does. And from time to time over the years, we have added other amendments to the Constitution.
165.
And so this is one of the issues we're dealing with these days, is if you take a look at the Ohio Constitution, it's a book compared to the U.S. Constitution, which is relatively short, sweet, and to the point. And I think one of the things that Constitution Revision Commissions, which is sort of the way we've done things, we did one in 71, there's a proposal to do one again, which would consist, I think the new one's going to have something like 32 people that the General Assembly has proposed, which would include some reps of each of the political parties, plus some people who are not affiliated with the parties, to a total of 32 people, who will sit around as a small commission to come up with ideas for what amendments might need to be proposed, and propose those so that the General Assembly would bring them forward as proposed amendments to the Constitution. You can amend the Constitution in Ohio several different ways. One way is that the legislature can bring forth amendments. The other way is the people can. Because we have initiative, people could bring forth, and they have from time to time, initiative constitutional amendments. But the idea of calling the Constitutional Convention is not something that's been particularly popular in the course of the last four or five times that it's been asked for.
Opponents, particularly the newspapers that I've read, say it would be chaos. I think it was a Columbus Dispatch, chaos. And I guess they're referring back to what happened in 1912 when all the special interest groups got involved. But the alternative seems to continue to rest the power in the hands of the legislature.
Right. It keeps it in the hands of elected office holders. I'm assuming that the governor and other elected office holders would have something to say in this process as well, rather than opening the door to a new constitutional convention. And it isn't just here in Ohio, because what we've seen here in Ohio in 1851 and again in 1912, it isn't just that you have a lot of interest groups convening on the State House. It's a lengthy process. From the time the people approved that convention in 1910, it took 2 years before the Constitutional Convention came up with those proposed amendments. Similarly, the 1851 Constitution took a great deal of time to bring forward. And the question is, when does your Constitution become so big, so long, so complicated that we've just got to step back five and say, maybe it's about time that we sort of rewrite this thing and make it a little smaller, simpler, and easier, a la the U.S. Constitution? Will that ever happen? Well, my guess is, offhand, when the Constitution gets so big and so bulky and so unwieldy, then probably the legislature itself will propose doing something about consolidating it. Now, whether that's going to happen in the near future, good question.
What are the advantages to getting something in the Constitution versus just getting a law passed? For instance, let's talk about something like same-sex marriage.
Well,
it's banned now in the Constitution. What would be that means that you can't come forward and pass a law now. You'd have to amend the Constitution.
Right. Generally speaking, in our system, whether we're talking the national system or the state system, we tend to make the amendment process more difficult than the legislative process. Constitutions are designed to be the bedrock of our entire system, and we want to make them relatively difficult to change so that when those changes are made, that they're going to last a while. stay a while, be around a while. Whereas legislation, if it's just a law, what the legislature does, it can undo in relatively short order. Same thing's true at the national level as well. So when we put something into the Constitution, it's because we want it to stick around for a while. Ohio's Constitution is kind of interesting in a sense. It sort of is a reflection. If you take a look at what fills up most of the Constitution, it is funding bills of one kind or another, where we're basically the people need to be asked by a constitutional amendment if we're going to be spending extraordinarily large sums of money over a lengthy period of time. That's a reflection all the way back to that 1851 Constitution, where the people said, you know, you fellas have been spending a heck of a lot of money without asking us about it, and we want that to change. And all the way from 1851 to now, that's still generally been the mood of the people. Nobody's really come forward recently and said, well, gee, maybe it would be better to keep from clogging up the Constitution to put these funding bills just back in legislative approach. And that's never been particularly popular.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for having this show.
You're welcome.
I have a simple question. It is, do you believe, since the founding of the Republic to today, that we're becoming more isolated from away from the officials? Like, for instance, if the president went out to speak in crowds like he does now, he's able to touch everything. But we have the era of television, now smartphones. So is that going to make us more isolated? And still, do we still have a republic?
Well, my initial response to that is, if anything, with the advent of electronic media and social media in particular, we're probably closer in some sense. If you go back to the early days of the Republic, there were relatively few of us, and we were spread out over an extraordinary expanse of space. And one of the reasons we had elections the way we held them was that at least once every so often we would bring everybody together in order to have an election. But the idea of being able to see a political messages night and day, 24 hours a day, like we see now, this was impossible back in the early days of the Republic. So if anything, we may be suffering from an overdose of information in the short run here now.
Talk about the good old days. Steve, thanks for your question. Take care. There's no organized group for or against issue one, so it makes you wonder. I mean, and I'm not sure there ever has been when it's come up in the past four times. Why did they make it an automatic issue? Why did they do it that way?
I think it goes all the way back to when our country was founded, when our state was founded. The idea that basically government should be responsive to the people, and once every 20 years or so, we're just going to ask them, are you satisfied with our structure of government or not? And what people have said uniformly for this over these last many years is, yeah.
Or, I don't know, so I'm not going to vote on it.
Well, that could be an issue as well.
Well, Ed Lenz, thanks for talking about it with us today.
My pleasure, Ann.
Issue one, it'll be on the ballot tomorrow. Ed Lenz, he's a local author and historian. He is the author of Columbus, The Story of a City, As It Were, Stories of Old Columbus, and his most recent book, Historic Columbus, A Bicentennial History. He's also a regular commentator for WOSU Radio and a consultant for our WOSU's Columbus Neighborhoods documentary series coming up. We'll turn to the probability that when tomorrow's over with, we may still not know who's president, who's going to be the next president of the United States. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk. But how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today with a high of 46 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight and chilly, a low of 29. Sunshine and a high near 50 for Election Day. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing seniors in Central Ohio with one-on-one support from caregivers who receive training, are bonded, and insured. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
What if we wake up Wednesday and the outcome of the presidential election of 2012 remains unclear? A lot is on the line. Just ask Al Gore.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time.
That was 36 days after the 2000 election when Florida's hanging chads held things up and the state eventually went red for George W. Bush, forever changing what could have been another historical election. This year, Ohio very well could be the deciding state, as we've heard over and over this campaign season, and the race is too close to call right now. So what if Ohio is too close to call after voting ends tomorrow? Ohio Secretary of State John Husted is confident that the voting process at least won't be an issue.
This system is as secure and consistent that it's as it's been. Our voter rolls are in the best shape they've ever been.
Time will tell. The question is, how much time? Joining us now to talk about the what-ifs is Professor Ed Foley. He's Director of Election Law at OSU's Moritz College of Law. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
So we saw it in Florida in 2000, and we'll be talking about that later. But in this presidential election, if it does come down to the Buckeye State, it could be weeks before we know the outcome. What's the timing of all of that? Why weeks?
There are three stages to the process after the ballots are cast on Election Day. The first is the process for verifying provisional ballots and waiting for absentee ballots to arrive that are entitled to arrive up to 10 days later. So that takes you to November 16th. Then on November 17th, the canvass can begin. And the canvass is actually the first official count of all the ballots. And under Ohio law, that can take a second 10 days, taking us out to November 27th. So we may not have an answer until November 27th. Now, it is possible that the canvass will move quickly, more quickly than that. It doesn't have to take all those.
Does the canvass have to occur in every county?
Yes.
Okay.
And then all 88 counties combine their results, send them to the Secretary of State, and then the Secretary will announce whether or not the final result is within the margin necessary for an automatic recount, and that's 0.25%. And so if that announcement were to occur on the November 27th, that triggers a notification period. And by the calendar, then the recount could start December 2nd. Now, of course, if the canvass ends sooner, you tack on basically 5 days to the day that the canvass ends. It all has to wrap up by Tuesday, December 11th, under federal law and state law. But that's the three steps of the process.
Could Ohio stand the scrutiny that Florida suffered in 2000, do you think, at this point?
Well, ask Minnesota after 2008, because they had that U.S. Senate election where Al Franken eventually became the winner. And, you know, they were under scrutiny for 8 months. Of course, it can't take 8 months in a presidential election. So any state, when put under this scrutiny, has hiccups and problems, and no election system is perfect. But Minnesota probably did a better job in 08 than Florida did in 2000. We'll only see, you know, time will tell if Ohio is put under that pressure.
To what extent do the provisional ballots add to the potential confusion?
Well, they're a new feature of our election system, so people don't understand them as well as some other features. And so there may be confusion for that reason, but it's really the new normal. They were added by Congress after 2000 in a federal law called the Help America Vote Act of 2002. And so they are now a regular part of the process. And because they're provisional in nature, you can't count them on Election Day. You have to wait that 10 days. And that's for the voter's benefit, too. The voter has those 10 days to come back and explain why they're a valid voter.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about that. Do they have to, on their own volition, go back? Or is it incumbent on the vote counters to ask the voters to come in and prove it if they're not sure?
That, unfortunately, is a little complicated. It depends on the particular reason why the provisional ballot was cast. If someone is forced to be a provisional voter, they should try to figure out from the poll workers exactly why, so that they have a sense of what that problem is. And if they want to be proactive, they should use that 10 days as much as they can to their advantage. If it's a missing ID, to supply the ID. If it was an issue with voter registration, to explain why they think they're registered. And there are voter protection groups out there to help voters who are in that problem.
Now, if it doesn't end by December 11th, could we come down to something like they did in Florida, where the U.S. Supreme Court gets involved?
It's possible. The Supreme Court did end it in 2000 precisely for the same reasons of the federal law, the federal calendar. And so you could imagine people trying to go back to the U.S. Supreme Court this year to get a similar result. If we go past the December 11th date, sort of all bets are off at that point.
If it's a close election and provisional votes change the course of the election, Bill Anthony, the Franklin County Elections Director, has said he expects litigation. You've said the same thing, I think. What form would that litigation take? How would that work? Or is this all this litigation that would have to be resolved by December 11th, no matter what?
Yes, all the litigation should be resolved. And the reason for that is Congress has promised all states that if they resolve by that date, Congress will honor whatever the state does. Now, the litigation can take many different forms, again, depending upon the particular details of the provisional ballots involved.
Well, I think that's about it. Ed Foley, Director of Election Law at the OSU Moritz College of Law, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we're going to hear from our next guest. Well, maybe we don't have them yet. Maybe we can take Abraham right now. Hey, Abraham, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Ed Foley's still here.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering.
Yeah?
I was just wondering if the director, election director, could be a neutral body instead of, Republican or Democrat. I think it could be influenced. It could
okay.
be
influenced. Let's see. Ed Foley?
Yes, that's a great idea. There are many scholars of the election process all around the country who would recommend that. Wisconsin has actually moved to that system to its benefit. Most states, unfortunately, don't have that and instead have an elected official running the elections process.
Abraham, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Now I'm going to say goodbye to Ed Foley. Once again, thanks, Ed, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ed Foley, he's Director of Election Law at OSU Moritz College of Law, joining us now. Rahm Emanuel, he is, of course, the mayor of Chicago and former chief of staff for the Obama administration. Welcome to the show, Rahm Emanuel.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. President Obama is on the last legs of his centipede of a campaign, I guess, for reelection. He's traveling with Bruce Springsteen and Jay-Z to Ohio, Iowa, and Wisconsin before returning to Chicago, right, tomorrow to await the vote. This is, these are the final hours. How does the ground game change, and particularly in a state like Ohio, at this point?
Well, I don't think you change it. I think you execute it, meaning you, at this point, don't call an audible 11th hour. You know where your voters are. You know who you have to get out. They've been doing it, actually, because you have, obviously, like other states, like we do here, early voting, and they know exactly who their voters are, who needs a ballot, and how to motivate them either by the door, the phone, mail, or text messaging. And so I wouldn't change anything so much as double down on what you've been building for literally over a year.
I know you, I think you were in Florida recently. Are you traveling today?
Not today. I'm doing this. I have obviously a city, and the president's coming here tomorrow, mm-hmm. a city to run. But I was in Florida. I was the week the storm came through, or the weekend that storm came through, and obviously Cleveland was getting hit and part of Ohio, not obviously nowhere close to the coast. I was in Akron, Toledo, and Cleveland, and doing some work actually with the troops, riling them up to get ready to go door knocking.
I read where one Obama campaign activist said that the problem isn't Mitt Romney, his opponent, it's complacency.
Well, I mean, that you could say that almost in any election. That may be. I think if there's any state, it's Ohio, that knows the full, you know, full impact of the two differences between, or the differences between these two candidates, in the sense not just candidates, but their philosophy. One out of eight jobs in Ohio are tied to the auto industry. One person was willing to throw the towel in, another person said, not on my watch, and I was depressed. And when he entered the office of the presidency, the unemployment rate was a little over 10% in Ohio. Today it's at 7% and heading down. And that's about 150,000 jobs in this period of time, all related, and you can't even think about having achieved this goal if the auto industry had been, a towel had been thrown in on them like Governor Romney had advocated under his own penmanship. And the president made a decision that nobody at the time thought was possible to turn out the way it has turned out. And so I think that's a real testament to the kind of differences, in the sense I wouldn't say there's apathy. There's a sense of energy that people's jobs have been directly affected by a decision made in the Oval Office, and to the better in Ohio. These are auto jobs, auto-related jobs, and it's restructured to make it a competitive industry. And if any state has felt the decisions that come, and they're going to be coming in the future into the Oval Office, whose values and whose judgment do you want making? And I think President Obama's proven to the voters of Ohio he's got their back.
In these final hours, are the candidates trying to draw any interest from the undecideds, which, you know, they're narrowing all the time, but or are they just trying to get out the vote at this point?
Both. Trying to get out. Yeah, I mean,
how in the world do you influence an undecided at this point, if they haven't already?
That will be a question. At this point, I mean, when I was in Ohio, I was shocked how much it was on the air. We haven't had that, obviously, in Chicago until recently for our congressional races. At this point, I'm a little, I think some people will wonder, why is it that somebody's undecided this late? But, you know, they have to weigh a couple things of what they want to see in the future. And I think the president's made, think about the last week. He showed how the nation can respond when one part of the nation is adversely affected, like given what happened with Hurricane Sandy. He has shown what the government can do when the auto industry is on its knees and how to get it back up on its feet. And on Friday, we had and then during the week, we had two economic reports, one on retail sales that were better than what people thought, which means consumers are feeling just a little stronger, and then job numbers that were much better than what people thought or expected. So, and he was, for all practical purposes, both Colin Powell and Michael Mayer Bloomberg out of New York endorsed him, and then Chris Christie acknowledged that the president came by the side of New Jersey when they needed him, regardless of party. That is what the final week was, so an undecided voter has to look at that information and realize, in the next 4 years, do you want to test something else or go with something that's proven to have been effective leadership? And if any state knows it, it's Ohio, and the auto workers in the industry that's all related to a manufacturing economy.
Rahm Emanuel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Ed.
Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago and former chief of staff for the Obama administration. Joining us now is Tim Miller. We'll get him on the air. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
Tim is deputy communications director for the Republican National Committee. Mitt Romney is holding five rallies in four states today, including one this evening in Columbus, about 12 hours before polls open here tomorrow. It seems like they've never ended. Here to talk about the GOP ground game to win the White House and control of the House and Senate is RNC spokesperson Tim Miller. Mitt Romney has started to use teleprompters with his closing argument speech, which he debuted Friday morning in Wisconsin. Apparently, he doesn't want to take any chances at this point in the game.
Well, look, I think that these guys have been campaigning extremely aggressively over the course of the last week. And, you know, Governor Romney has a clear message for the voters of Ohio that if they want a new direction, if they want someone who's going to bring real change to Washington on day one and work with Republicans and Democrats to fix this economy and help the middle class, that he's the man to do it. And he has that consistent message today in Ohio and Florida and Virginia and New Hampshire and all the other places where he's stopping. And it's not going to end until his final rally tonight in New Hampshire around midnight.
The Romney campaign's been spending money and time in Pennsylvania in recent days, I guess the waning days. The campaign said it, well, I'm wondering if it's based on momentum in that state, or is it a last-minute effort to, you know, garner a few extra electoral votes if it gets really tight in Ohio?
You know, Pennsylvania is a state that I think that everyone has been surprised by how close it has maintained throughout the race. You know, the RNC and the Romney campaign had about 20 offices and 60 staff on the ground in Pennsylvania throughout this campaign preparing for this possibility. But, you know, President Obama won that state very handily 4 years ago. But, you know, this is a state, whether it's western Pennsylvania that's been disappointed with President Obama's energy policies on coal and the Keystone Pipeline, or, you know, these traditional Reagan Democrats who went back to the Democratic Party and President Obama in 2008, who haven't, are unhappy with the economic situation that they found themselves in and the president's economic policies. These folks have moved back towards Mitt Romney, and we're looking at a very close race. He had an event last night that had 30,000 people at it. It was larger than the last Bush rally in 2004 in the same location. And between those Reagan Democrats in western Pennsylvania and Governor Romney running well with folks in the suburbs of Philadelphia, we think that Pennsylvania is going to be tight just like Ohio all the way up through tomorrow night.
Now, as I said earlier, Mitt Romney is expected in Ohio tonight, but Politico is reporting that he will travel to Ohio again tomorrow on Election Day. Is he going to be back tomorrow?
You know, his final schedule is not out yet. I think that the campaign is looking at all the possibilities, and we'll make an announcement later today. But, you know, the only stop in Ohio currently on the schedule is the one in Columbus this evening. And, you know, as far as the campaign is concerned, they're looking at every possible opportunity to encourage Ohioans to get out to the polls, because, you know, every poll that you look at in this state is within the margin of error. Mm-hmm. And, you know, late-breaking voters, there are still a number of undecideds out there who are trying to decide if they want to continue with the same policies of the past 4 years or go a new direction. And Governor Romney's hoping we can persuade those last few voters to get across the finish line in Ohio.
Some pretty prominent Republicans are saying that Romney lost momentum with Hurricane Sandy. Do you think the president's response to the superstorm is going to affect voters in Iowa, Wisconsin, Florida, and Ohio? You know, the state's on the electoral bubble, but pretty far away from the, I guess, the storm.
Yeah, you know, with Hurricane Sandy, and this is an unprecedented event, mm-hmm. That there would be such a natural disaster of that kind so close to the election, and it's still unfolding. For folks in New Jersey and in New York and Staten Island, and even in Philadelphia, some people who still don't have power. So, you know, I think that's to be determined. You know, the campaign can only control what they can control, and that's, you know, working with our volunteers to turn out voters in Ohio and these swing states across the country tomorrow, and to make that closing message I've talked about bringing real change to Washington. So that's what's in our control. And in the meantime, you know, our thoughts and prayers are still with the folks in Staten Island and elsewhere still being affected by the hurricane.
Tim Miller, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much.
Tim Miller, he's Deputy Communications Director for the Republican National Committee. Coming up, we're going to revisit the election of 2000 in Florida with a reporter, a former reporter who covered it. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Election Eve, we'll talk with top pollsters and party strategists about the fate they see in the Election Day map. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. And on election night, turn to WOSU Public Media for up-to-the-minute in-depth coverage. Listen to a special All Sides with Ann Fisher at 7 p.m., followed by NPR's election coverage with updates from 89.7's Marilyn Smith. You can watch WOSU TV for a live Columbus on the Record election special at 7:30, followed by PBS NewsHour election coverage with updates on the Ohio vote. You can also track Ohio and the nation online at WOSU.org. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a look at big issues on the ballot. Around the country. Join us for that discussion from 11 till noon. And it's 39 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today with a high of 46 degrees. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 29. Support for 89.7 comes from the Midland Theater, presenting singer-songwriter Jonathan Kingham for an evening of folk, pop, country, and jazz as a part of its Stage Door Cabaret series. November 8th and 9th at the historic Midland Theater in Newark. More details and tickets at midlandtheater.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Remember 2000? Remember the Hanging Chads of Florida? If not, listen closely. It is the stuff of legends. That year, the presidential race not only was unresolved the night or day after voting, it took 5 weeks and confusing recount after confusing recount before the U.S. Supreme Court finally stepped in, overturned a state Supreme Court ruling, and ordered the last recount to stand, making George W. Bush, who had initially conceded the election, the winner. The experience changed us, at least us political junkies, and changed how many people vote. We're less sure of our systems of voting now in some places. And the voting process, especially during presidential election years, often is a front and center issue. It certainly has been in the battleground state of Ohio this year. Tim Nickens, he's now the editorial page editor at the Tampa Bay Times in Florida, was a reporter covering the presidential election in 2000. He joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hi, good to be with you.
Do you really like going back to memory lane on this issue?
It's a little bit scary. I've tried to ease that a lot out of my mind, but it was a historic time and fun to cover.
On Thursday, November 9th, 2 days after the election in 2000, you wrote that the state of Florida had started a remarkable recount of its votes. At the time, Al Gore appeared to have won. Did you have any idea at that point how messy it would get?
I don't think anybody had any idea, whether it was the media or the candidates, about exactly how difficult it was going to be, or certainly how it was going to turn out.
It started with Pinellas County, where they scheduled a second recount after they couldn't explain the differences in the numbers. And then it sort of snowballed from there.
It sort of snowballed from there, and then Al Gore, of course, at that time could choose how he wanted to approach it, and initially I think was going to focus on some South Florida counties alone, and then it kind of mushroomed from there.
In Volusia County, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, they surrounded the elections office in DeLand with crime scene tape after they were seen leaving with mysterious black satchels. I remember that.
Right. Well, we had a lot of very odd scenes all across the state. Volusia County, you had this sort of near riot in Miami-Dade at the elections office there, which later turned out that group was heavily composed of some congressional staffers. You had all sorts of things going on in multiple counties.
To our listeners, if you have a special memory about the election of 2000, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can tweet at WOSU All Sides. I still have my Christmas ornament filled with hanging chads from a elections office in Ohio, Tim Nickens. I'm wondering how let's go back to Jeb Bush, because he was the governor of Florida at the time, adding maybe some more doubt to the drama.
Oh, there was a lot of doubt and a lot of drama, and of course he was surprised himself, because he had to hustle back from Texas to Florida in the middle of the night, and I think landed in Tallahassee shortly before dawn. And, you know, this had never really happened before, so it was new ground, not just for the media, but for the campaigns and lawyers and the courts and everybody else.
Two former secretaries of state were sent, one each representing the candidates, and they were supposed to oversee the efforts. And I was wondering, what exactly did they oversee? There were all those people coming to Florida to observe. What did they see?
Well, I think they were really helping to oversee the ground games of both campaigns, to both make sure that they were represented in all of these counties and that they had the right lawyers in the right places, and also to spin the media, because they were really the public faces of the campaigns there in Florida for weeks as this went on.
As a reporter, did you feel confident you were seeing everything you needed to see?
I don't think we saw really what was going on behind the scenes, and it was only when people started reporting afterward, you know, and kind of reconstructing what really happened behind the scenes. We saw plenty of drama outside just in trying to get these votes counted, and so it was hard enough to follow what was going on hour by hour, much less trying to get behind the scenes to see what they were really trying to do.
Because in some ways you have two fronts now. You have the spin front, and then you have what's really going, the mechanical front of the process.
Right. I mean, you had more fronts than that, because you had to dispatch reporters all across the state to these different counties, each of which was playing out in its own little drama in public. Then you had these multiple court fights that were going up and down the court system, both the state and federal courts. And then, of course, you did have both campaigns running their own shows as well.
The Florida Secretary of State became something of a lightning rod in all of this. What happened with her?
Well, she faded away. Catherine Harris, ran for Congress back home in Southwest Florida, and was defeated. And she's gone back to private life. And that position of Secretary of State is no longer elected as well. There were already some constitutional reforms in the works, so that's not even an elected position anymore.
Is that because of 2000?
No, that was already in the works to kind of shrink the size of state government. So she just turned out to be the last elected Secretary of State.
Veronica from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Are you talking to Veronica?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks. Didn't hear the intro. Yes. Anne, you and I are from the same generation. I just had one funny memory I wanted to share, which those of us who are listening that are old enough would know is... all I can think of is the poor man that they kept showing on the news over and over again, looking at that ballot from every vantage point, if you know what I'm talking about.
I don't know. Was there one special guy they kept focusing on?
There was one special guy. I believe he was in South Florida, perhaps Palm Beach County. And I can see that picture, and he had that ballot up, and he was eyeballing it, and I think he had a magnifying glass out, trying to figure out what the heck he was looking at.
And was that the Hanging Chads moment?
I believe so.
Yeah, the Hanging Chads thing. Were you as startled by the arcaneness of it as we were up here?
Right. We got in. We certainly got way deep into the weeds and the minutia on Hanging Chad and all sorts of things that we never really talked about in the past.
You had written that it was likely that the state Supreme Court would take a beating from the legislature the following spring. Whatever happened to the Supreme Court?
Well, they actually survived quite handily. There had been some changes in the way these appellate judges are appointed, but there wasn't really any fallout at any of those specific justices, and they won merit retention, and they turned out to be fine.
It was interesting. You wrote that it would be up to Al Gore to establish the necessary national unity in his concession speech. What did you make of that speech and Al Gore going forward?
I thought that it was actually a very well done speech that had the proper tone and had to be incredibly difficult to deliver, given how he lost that election. And I think while he's sort of faded from spotlight recently, certainly in this campaign, he did some valuable work on global warming and some other energy initiatives in the years since 2000.
What about the Bush campaign? How did they react? What was their demeanor when it all came down? Because the nation was just in shock.
Well, they were confident from the beginning, at least from outward appearances, that they had won, and they were going to do everything they could, and they did do everything they could to what they considered was preserving a victory.
On the eve of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in that matter, you wrote that there were risks in relying on the court for a final decision. And one law scholar said that it looked like a, quote, naked partisan political organization, end quote. Was our collective view of the court changed with its involvement in the election of 2000, or have we recovered from that, do you think?
Well, I mean, again, it's a partisan discussion, but I think it hurt the courts, and I think it hurt the perceived impartiality of the court, particularly the U.S. Supreme Court. And there are still lots of folks that are angry about that decision in Florida today.
There is actually a museum in Tallahassee devoted to the 2000 election.
I don't know that there's an entire museum, but okay. there's some artifacts there, right?
Do people, you know, I was talking with an intern the other day and mentioned the Hanging Chads, and she looked at me blankly, and I realized there's a whole generation at least that doesn't remember this.
Right. My own daughters, who were able to vote for the first time in this election, of course, were so young 12 years ago that they knew Dad was gone a lot, but they... And they knew that the election was in doubt, but they don't remember all that sort of stuff that just seems legendary to us.
So what changed, do you think, from the 2000 election?
Well, in Florida, at least, quite a bit changed. I mean, we have a lot clearer standards now about how to count the vote. We've gone through two incarnations of voting machines. We switched to touchscreen machines, and then people didn't had some concerns about that. So now we're back to one sort of paper machine. So there's been, and now there, of course, campaigns are geared up on both sides with the lawyers all over the place and in a much more vigorous way than they ever were before 2000.
When it comes to the touchscreen, in the final analysis, how much did Florida spend on all of this? What did it cost?
Millions, tens of millions of dollars to both buy new machines and then decide that they didn't like those and then go back to these paper machines.
And do you think the voters in Florida are better educated about the process now?
In
Ohio, sometimes it seems like they're more confused.
Well, I think they're better educated. Unfortunately, I think they're also somewhat more cynical about the process. But I also think people are more determined than ever to vote because they know how close something can be, and that it is true that every vote counts.
In Ohio, we're looking at down to the wire race. What kind of advice do you give reporters who are covering it here?
Don't call it too soon. You know, that's going to be a very tricky thing tomorrow night, I think, both for reporters in Ohio and for the national media as this thing unfolds, if it's as close as it looks in the polls.
Well, even George W. Bush conceded the election himself. How do you? I mean, you had
right.
to report on that.
Well, right, and then at one point, Al Gore was headed there in the middle of the night to go concede, and got a phone call in the car that said, "Don't do it."
You said there's clearer standards. What was blurry about them before?
Well, there weren't there weren't any clear standards, and there weren't any clear statewide standards. So you had and. When you're looking at this Hanging Chad thing, there was no real clear, definitive standard about that. And that's ultimately what the courts hung their hat on, was that there was no common standard, because there was no common ballot. You know, people in different counties had different sorts of voting machines and different kinds of ballots. And so there was a lot of confusion about exactly what was a valid vote. And now you can look, and there's a long list of how the conditions and criteria when they're evaluating votes on whether they're properly cast.
There's been a lot of controversy in Ohio about early voting. What's the situation in Florida?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy here as well, because the legislature last year reduced the number of early voting days and from 14 to 8. And that meant that yesterday, which is a historically high voting day, particularly in African-American communities, was not technically an early voting day. So some enterprising election supervisors at the county level from around the state said, well, okay, then what we're going to do is you can still come into the elections office and we'll give you an absentee ballot, a mail-in ballot, and you can fill that out and we'll count that instead. And I thought that was a fairly innovative way to get around this restrictive law. But, of course, in a couple of places like Miami, it didn't work that well because a lot of people showed up and they weren't able to crank out these ballots and people got frustrated. And, and in fact, in Miami, they had to close down for a little while.
Why did the legislature vote from 14 to 8?
Well, the Republicans in the legislature will say that they were trying to be more efficient. And that it was a efficiency and a cost reduction decision. Democrats and, frankly, the editorial board of the Tampa Bay Times will say no, that they were trying to suppress the vote, because it's clear that Democrats more than Republicans like to go and vote early, while Republicans tend to favor mail-in ballots more. So that they were trying to cut down the number of early votes, and they have somewhat succeeded. It appears like to be so far.
I know you said don't count the vote too early, but what are your predictions? Any?
Well, I can look at the polls only as and talk to the same people that everybody else is looking at. I think it's going to be. Actually, I think it's going to be fairly close in Florida. We've had a couple of polls that suggest Romney is somewhat what passes as comfortably ahead. I'm not sure that's going to be the case, but I think it'll be close in Florida, and I think nationally it's still somewhat of a toss up.
Thanks for joining us, Tim. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Tim Nickens, he's editor of editorial page editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.